By June of 1995, the full attention of authorities had turned towards Patricia Rohr as the prime suspect in the murders of Joe and Alex Katranek. As they interviewed witnesses, a troubling picture of Patty emerged. According to multiple people who knew her, Patty was moody, spiteful, and was capable of violence. But no matter how terrible her personality might have been, from what investigators could gather, Patty was accounted for in North Carolina on the day before and the day of Joe and Alex disappearing. Then, a conversation with a local police officer led them to think that one of Patty's ex-boyfriends might be involved, and that this might be a murder-for-hire case, which was reflected in the June 1995 FBI memo with the subject line that stated as much. That ex-boyfriend, Walter Blalock, was bad news and was well known to local law enforcement. One officer called him, quote, one of the worst criminals in the area who had done everything short of murder. Blalock had a list of burglaries on his record and numerous arrests for stealing guns from cars and homes, which he then sold for drugs. As far as that officer was concerned, Blalock was absolutely capable of committing murder. The officer said that Blalock hated the police, but he might be willing to cooperate if he was in trouble. Either the police thought Blalock was involved in the murders or that he could give them information on their prime suspect, Patricia Rohr, so a few weeks later, they visited him. Blalock did indeed cooperate. He told the police that he and Patty had dated on and off since 1990, and while he knew that Patty had some ex-boyfriends in Pennsylvania, he didn't know them personally. It was his belief that Patty and Andy broke up because she drank too much, which she continued to do while she was dating Blalock as well. According to Blalock, Patty would compare him to Andy all the time, and he was sure that Patty never got over Andy. He told the police that he had been to Pennsylvania twice with Patty, once in 1991, where she showed him a trailer in Slatington, where she once lived. That, by the way, being the same town that the bodies were found in. The second time he went with her, he said, was in August of 1994. The couple took four horses to Pennsylvania to sell, and they stopped by at some stables that Patty used to rent out. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, Blalock told the police that a couple of years after they started dating, Patty bought a .22 caliber semi-automatic handgun from a yard sale. It was a small, nickel-plated gun with a wood grip, and the serial number scratched off. It was a junky gun, said Blalock, and months later he told authorities that the gun would often jam when fired, which caught Trooper Kochevar's attention because it was his theory that the killer's gun had jammed up during the commission of the crime, so instead they bludgeoned Joe to death. According to Blalock, Patty kept the gun either under a sofa cushion or a kitchen cabinet in the house, but whenever she went out, she carried the gun with her. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Patricia Rohr. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. Blalock got himself off the hook pretty quickly. He had proof that on the day that Joanne and Alex Katranek had disappeared in Pennsylvania, he was working in North Carolina. So while the murder-for-hire theory didn't pan out for the police, Blalock had given the police valuable information. First, he gave them a motive for Patty killing Joanne and Alex Katranek, that she had never gotten over Andy. Second, he placed a gun in her possession, a .22 caliber, the same caliber weapon that had been used to kill Joe. The wagons were circling around Patty, and investigators needed all the ammunition they could get against her, and sometimes the best ammunition comes from the suspect themselves. In this case, though, Patty refused to speak to the authorities, but they had an idea that she just might speak to a grieving father and husband, specifically her ex, Andy Katranak. On June 2nd, 1995, the police had Andy give Patty a call and record it.
Hello, stranger.
Hey.
How you doing?
Okay, you good?
Sounds so good.
What's up?
I don't know. Just curiosity's in me.
Curiosity?
Yeah.
About what?
Wondering why you haven't called. Looks like that.
I told you you wouldn't really talk to her around. Plus, I'm not too happy with the FBI knocking on my door.
And they recently told me about that.
What do you mean, recently told you that?
That they were down there.
They've been a pain in the butt, but they're down.
They've been down there a lot?
Well, they were in the beginning, and then they were right here again, I don't know, about a month ago, I guess. And I just told them they're barking at their own tree, and you need to find out who the hell they are and stop. I could talk to a number of about 20 or 30 people to find out where I was that night. They were kind of ticking Mom off, too. And
she was there?
Oh, yeah. They talked to her and all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah. They called me a couple of times to ask me stuff about you, but I don't know. I guess they have their suspicions. I guess what gets me is, you know, they're all kind of focusing on you. And, in the meantime, this asshole is walking around the streets.
Well, they were kind of putting us under the suspicion that you were pushing them towards me, and that was kind of what was ticking me and Mom off a little bit, too.
No way.
I told Mom, I said, I don't know, and Andy should know me better to know how I feel about kids, especially.
I suggest the opposite.
Well, they asked me if I contacted you, you know, they had found her and stuff, and I said, no, and they fly, and I said, well, just, you know, decided to get a hold of him, but I'm sure he has enough to deal with on his own right now, and it got to the point where I was scared to call it there. You know, I feel like my phone's tapped and everything else.
I doubt that. I can't do that without you knowing it.
Oh, yes, I can. It was like I told them after this great argument I was supposed to have with this lady. I said, I don't even know her, and if it, I'd got my phone bill if it was a one-minute phone call. I said, do you realize the minute you call anybody, your bill for a minute? I didn't argue. I said, she told me not to call anymore. I hung up and went, shit, okay. She couldn't do, you know, new mother bitters that I've had when I had mine, so I didn't think nothing of it.
You called from down there?
That's when you told them we had this big argument and stuff.
I didn't tell you it was a big argument.
You even told Mom that.
I said it was, I said exactly what Joanne had said. I didn't say it was an argument.
Mom said that you told her that we had wound up in a hell of a sight and an argument.
No way.
I said, shit, she said about four sentences to me. I said, I didn't get much in other than why are you tossing like this and, you know, what's wrong? And I said, she slammed the thumb down on me and I was hung up too. Okay. But I didn't, you know, want to really, but I didn't realize there was a problem.
They were telling me that they somehow found out that you were up here during that, around that time.
Yeah. They said I was up there?
Mm-hmm.
That's funny, they haven't checked any of my alibis down here.
Here's where Patty brings up another alibi that the police have to figure a way around.
I was dance class that night. I was at my feed store that afternoon. Hell, my dance class, I don't know how many people up there. I mean, I gave the dance instructor's name and told him to go talk to him.
In case you didn't catch that, Patty's referring to a dance class and saying that she even gave the police her dance instructor's number to verify that she was there.
They don't, you know, they tell me very, very little. But they said they found some inconsistencies.
It would be kind of hard since they haven't talked to any of them yet. Because I went back and questioned them and asked them, did you have FCI people talking to you? You know, because this is embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is.
You don't have to tell me.
Well, I don't mean it that way. I mean, I understand in your situation you want them to, but...
No, I mean...
You're somebody out of my path from years, and it's like they're coming down here and questioning, and people looking at me seem to question you about murdering a woman and a child.
How come you told me you weren't up here when you were?
I wasn't up there.
They said they know you were up here, I don't know, like within the last year. They said you haven't been up here since. That's bullshit with whatever the hell his name was, Hewitt.
The only time I can remember, and I told Mom I forgot I wasn't anywhere near there. I went to a horse auction up there.
When was that?
Shit. Close to a year ago. I mean, because Walter and I broke up for almost a year now, I would say. Been 8 months, I guess. I've been going out with this and someone else for over 6 months.
I'm always ready to upgrade my routines, and recently I heard about the Rinco, a chewing gum that actually makes your teeth stronger every time you use it. The Rinco is better for you chewing gum that uses the same mineral your teeth are made of to support daily enamel health. The Rinco uses nanohydroxyapatite, the mineral your enamel is actually made of, to strengthen your enamel and repair damage. It comes in tons of flavors including mint, cinnamon, bubblegum, and berry. They have a really great fluoride-free toothpaste too. The Rinco sent me their cinnamon gum, and I'm a huge fan. Tastes great, the flavor lasts long, and my mouth always feels fresh afterwards. And as a bonus, it's led to my teeth looking whiter. I chew it every day after lunch to take me through the rest of the afternoon. And it feels good to know that I'm helping my teeth stay strong and healthy every time I use it. It's a totally effortless way to make sure you're taking the best care of your teeth possible. And right now, the Rinco is offering our listeners up to 50% off at buylarine.com/justice. That's buylarine, LARINE.com/justice for up to 50% off. In case you don't recall from last week's episode, one of the reasons in the FBI murder for hire memo that Patty was suspicious was because she lied about being in Pennsylvania in 1994. The memo actually says that Patty stated the last time she was in Pennsylvania was in 1994. There's no actual source for this information, no interview report of Patty saying any such thing, and here, as she's speaking to Andy, she says clear as day the last time she was in Pennsylvania was for a horse auction about a year earlier. In other words, in 1994.
Seems like right now, they're hung up on you.
I don't understand why they're even looking down here, though. She wasn't ever down here or found down here, and I don't care what they say, was not up there anywhere near that time. You know, I've got more than enough witnesses on that. I think somebody around here would have to notice you missing.
Patty makes a good point here. If she was gone long enough to drive from North Carolina to Pennsylvania, commit the murders, and then drive back, someone would have had to know she was missing. We'll get into the details of this when we discuss Patty's defense, but suffice to say that the authorities were never able to identify a single witness who could testify that Patty was missing from North Carolina when Joe and Alex disappeared.
Well, it's bugging me. You know, I get angry and angry every day. These assholes out there walking around, and they tell me they're looking at you, and pretty much exclusively looking at you, and it's like, you know, look where you're supposed to be looking.
Patty's as irritated as Andy with the investigators, especially because even though she had given them her exact whereabouts immediately after the disappearance, months later, they still hadn't verified her alibis.
Because they're not, if they'd have went to these people the first time they talked to me, I mean, it would have been very simple. But now they wait months and months and months later.
Well, that's what's pissing everybody off up here.
And hell, I say, even if they went to the dance club with my neighbor now, they both remember it because, I mean, that morning when Mom got me up, it was like I never went back to sleep because I was like, shit, you know, what the hell's going on? And I talked to my neighbor that morning and everything else, and, I mean, she remembers it vividly because of that. And I went to bed. The dance class, I went back out that night. Now, I said, what the hell's wrong with you? You're fine last night. And I told a couple of people what was going on. And I tried to tell the, you know, state police that. I said, is he? They said, well, they won't remember the day. I said, yes, they will. I said, because Thursday night, I'm fine. I said, Friday, I'm kind of spacey and just not as happy as usual. And they asked me what's going on. And I told them, you know, an old friend of mine has some trouble and told them what was going on. They will remember it. And you would think they'd even make a phone call to these people, and they haven't.
They had beat around the bush a lot, but Andy needed to lock Patty down on one important detail still.
They could have done that real simple. I mean, if they'd have contacted any of these people. I mean, a nightclub isn't gonna lie for you.
When did you call Joanne?
Hell, you'd know that as well as I did. A week or two before? I don't even remember. What was it?
I thought it was, you know, a few days.
I didn't think it was that week. I thought it was at least the week before Mom asked me that. I wasn't sure. I could get my phone bill, actually, and probably pinpoint it, but I didn't even take attention. What?
You know, they asked me, and I just, for some reason, I seem to remember Murphy Brown being on. Stupid.
I can't even tell you when she's on because I don't watch it.
I don't usually either. Usually in bed by then.
Wasn't that late though, was it?
Huh?
I didn't think it was that late. That you'd be in bed, girl, I want to call.
We start 6, no.
Oh. Because I'm going to say I didn't think I'd call that late. Now, they questioned me about that, if I'd ever met her, if I'd disliked her or had anything against it. I don't know. How can I do Pinehurst? The only time I talked to her before, she was friendly on the phone. If that would kind of stun me.
When did you talk to her before?
That very first time you guys were, I guess you weren't living together yet or something.
Yeah.
Remember I called up there and asked to talk to you, and she was like, yeah, hold on. And that's when you weren't, that's when I knew you were going to get married, because I joke with you back. You know, you get married or something, you ask her when we get married, and she said to Moss. I was saying, it was just, I breathe things the same way, you know, with Andy there. And she said, yeah, hold on. She seemed real, I even told you, she seemed friendly or not.
She was.
Well, some friends, only, that's the only thing I had to bear it against. I couldn't understand her the last time I called, and she was, you know, not friendly at all. I just figured it, you know, with a new baby and all. I just didn't think nothing more of it. That's when I called Andy, I said, you've got my phone workers, maybe it was 3 to 6 months. I said, just
wasn't even that.
No, that's the last time I thought. I said, that's all I knew. You know, he should have had a baby. So last time I talked to him, he was going to have a child. They're going to move to Colorado. I said, that's fine. I just got back from four finals.
What? From what?
Why is this thing beeping?
What?
The phone.
No,
I got a call coming in. Hold on a minute.
No.
Real quick, hold on.
Sure.
A clear narrative was building momentum against Patty now. Multiple people had confirmed she was moody and could get violent, and the picture only got worse when the police learned that Patty had animal cruelty charges against her. On July 25th, 1995, the police interviewed Fonda K. Eggers, who was a Davidson, North Carolina County Humane Society investigator. Eggers had led an investigation against Patty when, the previous year, reports had reached the Humane Society that Patty was neglecting horses that she was boarding in Davidson County. A few weeks after the investigation was opened, Patty moved her horses to Randolph County, and according to Eggers, she left them without food and water for weeks. The culmination of that investigation was that in September of 1994, Patty had been charged with abandonment of animals in Randolph County and also faced cruelty to animal charges in Davidson County. The abandonment charges were eventually dropped, but Patty pleaded guilty to the cruelty charges in Davidson County on December 12, 1994. One of the conditions of her plea was that she had to prove to a county officer that she was purchasing grain and feed weekly for her horses. Ironically, as terrible as these charges look for Patty, the entire incident is in fact instrumental in her defense, but we will get to that in next week's episode. Back in 1995, however, animal cruelty looked pretty bad for Patty, and it further cemented the picture being created about her. And it only got worse when investigators were told that she also had a problematic relationship with children. None of us has any time to waste anymore. That's why the best summer pieces are the ones that you can wear on repeat. The ones that are comfortable, versatile, and somehow right for every single occasion. That's why I love Quince. They make elevated essentials using premium materials like European linen, organic cotton, and washable silk without the traditional retail markup. Quince's 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops are the same pieces you're going to reach for all summer long, over and over. They are lightweight, effortless to style, and they start at just $32. Their denim is soft and comfortable, and their organic cotton sweaters are perfect for layering when it gets cool in the evenings. And then there's Quince's beautiful 14 gold jewelry, which adds a subtle finishing touch. Simple hoops or delicate chains make even the most effortless outfit feel intentional. And everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They work directly with ethical factories and cut out the middlemen, so you are paying for exceptional quality, not brand markup. One of the couple of pieces I have found myself wearing over and over again, one I just got recently, is Quince's 100% European linen midi slip skirt. It is sleek and simple, it is sophisticated, and it is just beautiful. It elevates every single outfit. You can put it on with a t-shirt, you can put it on with something silk. I just love it. And Quince doesn't just have apparel. Quince also offers elevated essentials for your home, from bedding and bath to kitchen essentials and furniture. So make your summer wardrobe feel easier. Go to quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/towardjustice for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/towardjustice. Not long after investigators turned their full attention towards Patty, they interviewed a woman by the name of Dawn Walters. Walters and Patty had first met when they worked together at Century 21 many years earlier in Allentown, Pennsylvania. At the time, Patty was living with Andy Katranek, but she later broke up and began dating a fellow employee named Richard Dabrowski. Walters and Patty worked together, but they also socialized outside of work, hanging out at TJ's bar near a stable where Patty boarded her horses. Walters had been to the stables a few times and even gone riding with Patty. In other words, Walters didn't just have a professional relationship with Patty. It was also personal. She knew a lot about Patty's private life at the time and about her personality. Unfortunately, she didn't have much nice to say. As others had also told the police, Walters confirmed that Patty was moody and unpredictable. She remembered once going to Patty's boyfriend's house and watching her trash the place. That boyfriend, by the way, was Conrad Hewitt, the same boyfriend who was arrested for assaulting Patty. Walters recalled that Patty had ended up pregnant when she was dating Dabrowski, and he wanted the baby, but she didn't. Patty elected not to keep the baby, and shortly afterwards, she went back to Andy Katranek. Eventually, Walters distanced herself from Patty because of how she acted out and because of the people she was hanging out with. Now, one can only imagine how this information about a potential abortion shaped the opinion and perspective of middle America male investigators towards Patty, but their interest in Patty's relationship with children was certainly warranted given the case. In an interview with a different witness, this time the sister of Conrad Hewitt, investigators were also told pretty terrible things about Patty's behavior, including incidents that could only be described as threatening, manipulative, and outright unhinged. It wasn't just Patty, though, according to this witness. Patty's mother, Mrs. Chambers, was just as unpredictable and menacing. Both Patty and her mother had threatened to shoot the witness and her brother more than once. Finally, and perhaps of greatest interest to the police, was that Hewitt's sister told them that Patty once said that she hated children.
Patty's relationship with children was of keen interest to the investigators. They had learned that Patty had also once been a mother, which they felt was key information that could be used for her or against her. In January of 1982, long before she met Andy Katranak, she married a man named Gary Gabbard. In many ways, that marriage was an escape from a turbulent family life, and while her mother opposed the marriage because Gary was 9 years older, there wasn't much she could do to stop Patty after she had turned 18. That same year, Patty and Gary had a baby boy on August 19th, 1982, and named him Charlie. The marriage wasn't a happy one to begin with. Beyond the age difference, Gary was both physically and mentally abusive to Patty. Their fights were so bad that neighbors would call the police, and after having the baby, things only got harder with the stress of an infant. Part of that stress was that Patty's mother, Mrs. Chambers, who had recently lost her own husband, was too involved in the baby's life. Of course she would be. After all, she was a free babysitter, as both Patty and Gary had full-time jobs but couldn't afford daycare. Gary was annoyed by how much both Patty and Mrs. Chambers were attached to the baby, and he once complained that Charlie belonged more to the two women than they did to him. On November 20th, 1982, when Charlie was only 3 months old, they lost him. There are two versions of this story. According to Gary, Mrs. Chambers had been babysitting him as always, and after work, Patty and Gary picked the baby up and went home. Patty then put Charlie down for a nap, and Gary and her took one too. Hours later, they awoke, and Patty went to check on the baby, but she didn't return for a bit. When she did come back, she looked out of it and told Gary that something was wrong with the baby. According to Patty, though, that wasn't at all what happened that day. Charlie had been fussing all day, and when she put him down for a nap, she rolled him over to rub his back and help calm him down. When it looked like he was asleep, Patty then went to give her mother a call, and when she came back to the nursery, she saw that the baby was not breathing. Patty screamed, Gary came running, tried to do CPR, they called 911, and within minutes the first responders arrived. Tragically, their efforts at reviving Charlie failed. An autopsy determined the cause of death was SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. Nearly everyone who knew Patty from that time has said the loss of her son devastated her, that it changed her permanently, and that she never recovered. After Charlie's death, Patty and Gary's marriage deteriorated further and became even more abusive. But Patty still didn't leave, not until the day that Gary kicked her in the chest and fractured her sternum. That was when the sheriff urged her to get out or risk dying at her husband's hands. You would think the tragedy of losing a baby would have been a reason to sympathize with Patty. But during the murder investigation, when police asked her about the loss of her son, it was with suspicion, hinting that Patty may have had something to do with the baby dying. According to Patty, FBI Special Agent Dwight Ayers even had the gall to say to Patty that she should be over Charlie dying by now, because it had been a long time ago. That was the final straw for Patty, and she stopped cooperating with them.
If that was true, I don't know why they haven't pushed it any farther.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Like I said, what's getting me is they're all looking at you and instead of doing what they should be doing. And
I can't figure why. I mean, and like I said, they even told me this is what kind of, I guess another reason we haven't called you, they kind of set us up against you even. They said, you know, if they come down here, Andy, and ask me about Charlie, or they didn't ask me, they're going to go busy with my mom. And this is where I give up talking to him and didn't want anything different with her and said, does your daughter have a child? Or didn't she have a child? Mom said, well, yeah. That's what happened to him. And she said he died of Cruise syndrome. And they looked at her and said, are you sure that's what it was? Did you try to do CPR? Was there a death certificate? And the questions kept going and I told him, did she tell him where the fuck to go? And saying that I guess you had told him I had a hard time with it. And I said, how would anybody?
I mean, that's normal.
I said, I think
I still have right now.
Oh, he come to my door then. But well, he talked to me and I said, I have nothing to say to you anymore. I said, you don't dig up my dead child from, I said, 12 and a half years ago. And he said, well, that can you pass? That shouldn't bother you now. I said, you don't have any children, do you? I said, my son will never be in my path, mister.
I can understand that now.
I guess I told Mom in that way I felt bad. I said, because I understand part of what you're going through. I said, not totally. I said, you know, I didn't, my husband was an asshole, but I didn't lose him. I know you don't understand there's other reasons you wouldn't right now, but I'm not real happy with anybody accusing me of hurting your child either.
Well, that's, you know, I'll tell you exactly what I told them. I said, you know, when the bodies were found and they asked me about you, and I said, no. I said, anybody that's lost a child would not do this.
A clear narrative had emerged against Patty now. A difficult, unstable woman with a violent streak, one who hated children, to the point of terminating a pregnancy and perhaps even having a hand in the death of her own son, despite the evidence, the actual autopsy report being to the contrary. Here's the thing about narratives, though. You can spin any given set of facts any way you want them to be perceived. For example, even if the police accepted that Patty had nothing to do with her son's death, that tragedy could easily be spun into a motive that she killed Joe and baby Alex because she was jealous that Joe had a baby and a family. The point being, the case against Patty was steadily being made through anecdotes about her past behavior, things she said or did, and even things that happened to her. None of this, however, was hard evidence. Investigators had to abandon the murder-for-hire theory, which meant if Patty was behind the murders, she committed them with her very own hands. But the police had three major hurdles to overcome. One, that the narrative fell apart when it came to the phone call, the one that Andy said triggered Patty to drive all the way to Pennsylvania and kill his wife and child. Phone records show that there was no phone call made from Patty's house, or even her mother's house, to the Katranack residence in the days before the disappearance. Rather, records show that she called more than a week earlier, which was what Patty herself had told the police. So this kind of complicated the story that Patty was so enraged by Joe hanging up on her that she immediately set out for Pennsylvania. A second complication for police was that Patty's own mother, Mrs. Chambers, said that she personally saw Patty on the day that Joe and Alex disappeared, and also that she called and talked to Patty in the middle of the night. And Patty was in bed when Andy called to ask her where Patty was. The third obstacle for the police was this, that there was another alibi, one that we haven't even mentioned yet. It was a strong alibi with multiple witnesses that said that Patty was in North Carolina on the night that Joe and Alex were reported missing. Patty had told police that on the evening of December 15th, 1994, she was at a country dance club, and she gave them the name of multiple witnesses, including her dance instructor who could vouch for her. Shockingly, authorities didn't let any of these things get in the way of their pursuit of Patty, and in next week's episode, we will go through how they were able to deal with each of these hurdles at trial. In the course of the investigation, though, what they needed was evidence that was so indisputable that no amount of alibis could overcome it. And that, of course, had to be physical evidence tying Patricia to the murders.
The bulk of the forensic evidence the police gathered from the crime scene was hair. Plenty of it. There was a patch of dirty blonde hair that was stuck to the back of the driver's side seat of Joe's car. And then there was the hair found at the crime scene itself. Many hairs were recovered from both the car and the area that Joe and Alex were found. More than 200, in fact. But when it came down to it, investigators decided to focus on only 8 of the hairs. The 6 taken from the car, as well as 2 found at the site of the bodies. One of those 2 was a hair recovered from the baby blanket that was found next to Alex, as well as 1 hair that was stuck to the diaper bag. There was one more hair, though. A hair that you would think would be the most important hair collected this entire case, that was nearly neglected. That hair was found in Joe and Katranack's right hand. You heard that right. There was a hair, a single hair, that was found in Joe's right hand. That hand was outstretched to her side, buried under leaves. We'll get to exactly how that hair was treated by the man in charge of forensically examining the crime scene evidence in a later episode, but for now, the investigators had a bunch of dirty blonde hair on their hands and a prime suspect who had long, dark, straight hair. On November 8, 1995, a warrant was issued for Patty's hair and blood. The probable cause portion of the warrant stated, among other things, the following. 6 hairs from the backrest of the driver's seat of her, Joe's, vehicle were submitted to the Pennsylvania State Police Regional Crime Laboratory for examination, where Thomas E. Jensen conducted a microscopic examination of the hairs. Jensen did determine that the hairs did not originate from either victim or Andrew Katrinak. It is the opinion of the forensic scientist Jensen that the hairs were darker at the root than the rest of the hair and consistent with long, dirty blonde hair.
That same day, 2 local detectives picked Patty up and took her to Lexington Memorial Hospital in Lexington, North Carolina. Patty sat in the back of the police car reading the search warrant, and when she got to the part that said dirty blonde hair, she commented, "This is not right. This is saying dirty blonde hair. I don't have dirty blonde hair. Look at my hair. It is not dirty blonde." Patty was right. Her hair was long and dark brown, but she was forgetting something. A year earlier, Patty's hair was permed and bleached. She had kept it that way for years. At some point, investigators had discovered a photograph of Patty, taken in the weeks before Joe and Alex's disappearance. In the picture, you see Patty standing in a cowboy hat in the middle of a group of men with a proud smile on her face. In her hand, she's holding up what appears to be a certificate or some piece of paper, as if showing it off to the camera. That photo ties directly back to the phone call that Patty made to Andy on the fateful day that Joe hung up on her. Patty had called Andy to tell him that she had competed and placed at the U.S. Petting Nationals in Oklahoma. She had gone to Oklahoma on December 1st and returned on December 5th and had been calling all of her friends to tell them about the win. That picture of Patty, taken with her team after winning in Oklahoma, shows her with shoulder-length hair, permed in the style of the early 90s, dark at the roots, the length of it, dirty blonde. Next time on Undisclosed. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more Undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, with the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.